This edition of The Recap was first broadcast on the 16th of May, 2015, on Monocle 24. Hello, I'm Daniel Giacopelli, and welcome to The Recap, bringing you the highlights from the past week's live news programs right here on Monocle 24. Over the next half hour, we'll bring you some of the very best interviews and reports from The Globalist, The Briefing, Midori House, and The Monocle Daily. Coming up, John Kerry went to Sochi this week for some diplomatic wrangling. But what did he hope to gain from meeting his Russian counterpart and the big man himself?
I think that something might be moving somewhere, and he wants to get an idea of whether Russia has got some wiggle room on Assad, withdrawing somewhat, perhaps, their support for him.
Then in other diplomatic travel news, François Hollande took a trip to Cuba this week to meet with the brothers Castro, the first such visit by a French president. We analyzed the Paris-Havana relationship over the years.
There have been very deep and long-standing cultural links with France. France has had very warm ties, has been very involved when there was a revolution, I think, and there were a lot of French people kicked out of Santo Domingo. So there is a historical link.
And later in the show, with Monocle's first two travel guides fresh off the press, Josh Fenner revisits some of the most reliable travel companions to date.
My very first love and primary motivation for pursuing a career on the printed page were, in fact, the Lonely Planet travel guides. The distinctive blue-bordered books, the curly loops and finials of its logo, and the relentlessly dense listings sparked something in me.
All that and much, much more coming up in the next half hour right here on The Recap with me, Daniel Giacopelli. We begin today's show in Israel, where Benjamin Netanyahu managed to form a last-minute coalition with the nationalist pro-settler Jewish Home Party last week. One of the conditions of the deal saw the hard-right 39-year-old computer engineer Ayelet Shaked become the new justice minister. Well, on Monday's edition of The Briefing, Marcus Hippie spoke with Daniela Peled, an editor at the Institute for War and Peace Reporting.
She's an interesting figure, and she's certainly central to the rise of Habayit Hayyudi, Jewish Home Party, which previous incarnations was as the settlers' party, the national religious party, quite dusty, quite old-fashioned, populated by middle-aged men with beards and women wearing headscarves. She, however, is a former computer engineer. She's born and raised in Tel Aviv, still lives there. She's secular, and she is, although it seems it's usually inappropriate to say this, she is a very attractive young woman. Now, this matters because, as I said, Jewish Home really rebranded themselves before the last elections. Its leader, Naftali Bennett, is also very far away from this dusty, bearded settler look. He doesn't live in the West Bank. He's clean-shaven. He dresses normally. He's got a small kippah on his head. And similarly, Ayelet Shaked does not seem to be anywhere near the traditional image of a settler, of a right-wing zealot, although I think it's fair to say that's exactly what she is.
And Shaked has also already received threats as well, has received bodyguards. She's a controversial figure. How much do we know what she actually wants to achieve in her position as a justice minister? Has she said much?
Well, yeah, I mean, she's in the power. I mean, people always are freer with their rhetoric when they're not in a position of direct responsibility. But she's a supporter of the so-called Jewish nation state law, which would define Israel as the nation state of the Jewish people. She has been quite clear that she thinks that the liberal left and the judiciary has too much power. She's also one of the supporters of the so-called NGO law, which would limit funding for NGOs who are funded from abroad, which is seen as targeting Israel's array of left-wing NGOs monitoring the occupation and the army. So I think her views on what constitutes justice are fairly clear. She also sits on some committees, for instance, for the advancement of Arab women in senior positions and women in the IDF and so on. I mean, there could be a range of views represented, but I think that's a pretty optimistic reading.
And looking at how controversial figure she is at the moment, how stable is her position going to be? What do you think?
Well, the story is that she wasn't expecting this position, but Naftali Bennett being put in a very strong position by the withdrawal of Avigdor Lieberman, said that he was going to put her in this. This was his demand for justice minister. She's as stable as this entire coalition. I mean, unfortunately, Israeli cabinet ministers don't seem to have a particularly shaky position for coming out with right-wing and controversial opinions. But Netanyahu's government has a majority of exactly one. So she looks set to continue for as long as the rest of her chums do.
Daniela Pellet there from the Institute for War and Peace Reporting with Monocle's Marcus Hippie. Now to Russia, where after sitting down with his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov, the U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry met with Vladimir Putin in the Black Sea resort of Sochi, the highest level visit of a U.S. official to Russia since the Ukraine crisis began. Kerry tested the country's willingness to pull back its involvement in Ukraine and also its support of Syria's President Assad. But with relations between Russia and the U.S. at a new low, what could such talks really achieve? Well, on Tuesday's edition of Midori House, Tom Edwards spoke with Mary Dejevsky and Roger Boyes.
My instinct is that it's less about Ukraine and more about Syria, because something seems to be changing in Syria. Kerry, after he's been to Turkey, will go to Camp David, where the Gulf monarchs are meeting with Obama, and they're very concerned about Syria too. I think that something might be moving somewhere, and he wants to get an idea of whether Russia has got some wiggle room on Assad, withdrawing somewhat, perhaps, their support for him.
Well, let's just sort of loop back and talk a little bit more about Russia and Ukraine. A report called Putin War has been published by the Open Russia news site, which features data gathered by the opposition politician Boris Nemtsov, who was murdered back in February, claiming Moscow spent over $1 billion supplying rebels in the east of Ukraine. It also suggests that at least 220 Russian soldiers have died in fighting there. And Mary, I wonder, do we know how reports like this or others are received in Russia, if indeed they get the opportunity to see the light of day at all?
Well, they do get the opportunity to see the light of day because a lot of Russians have access to the internet. There's a flourishing internet culture there. There's a big blogosphere, and there is no censorship. It's not like China. The blogosphere in Russia is open. So that material will be available to people who want to see it. The problem, of course, is that the number of people who would be even remotely interested in it is probably very small. And the number of people who will actually believe what they see, instead of looking at it as it were, almost a propaganda volley from beyond the grave, I think that, in a way, is the biggest danger. I think also, I mean, there was a theory before Boris Nemtsov was killed that this particular dossier was one of the reasons why there were people who wanted him eliminated and off the scene. And I never really accepted that theory. I think there were all sorts of other reasons why Nemtsov might have been assassinated. But the extent to which there is opposition to Russia's involvement in eastern Ukraine, there is a question over that, and there is also a question about the veracity and the reliability of the information as far as Russia's involvement is concerned. And I don't say that from a sort of hugely propagandistic point of view, but I think the number of absolutely reliable reports about the extent of Russia's involvement is very, very small.
Roger, let me ask you about that, because, you know, the report makes these claims. They're quite specific. Russia, of course, denies having sent regular troops. And Mary really touches upon one of the fundamental problems here, which is the acquiring of accurate information. I mean, how much does that present a problem, I guess, to both sides of the discussion when it's all so obscured by the difficulty in gathering this sort of information?
Well, I think it was quite well researched, the report, as some of Nemtsov's previous reports have been, for example, about the Sochi Olympics. There's a bit of hearsay in, there's a bit of vagueness in details, but I think it's quite a good, solid document. But as Mary says, if we think it's going to affect Russian public opinion, then of course we're quite wrong. But I think its value is because the renewal of sanctions is coming up. The first major round of EU sanctions came after the shooting down of the Malaysian airliner last July. Well, that has to be renewed, and the discussions are already beginning within the European Union about that. And it's important if you want to keep a sanctions regime alive, at least until December, when the Minsk agreement is supposed to be complete, then you have to convince those countries who are looking for an excuse to withdraw from sanctions against Russia. This is why I'm a little bit skeptical that there will be any change on Ukrainian policy, by the way, with Kerry, because I think everything now has to play out at least to the end of the year, more or less as it's been set up. That's to say, sanctions have to be renewed. There has to be pressure on Russia, but also on Ukraine, to withdraw heavy weaponry and make sure that those basic precepts of the peace accord are implemented. And you can't really change any of the building blocks until that happens or doesn't happen in December. And that's why I'm thinking that trip of Kerry's, it's just purely symbolic, really. It's just a pure, vaguely a goodwill gesture, but no more than that. It's certainly, there'll be no movement on Ukraine as a result of it.
That was a highlight from Tuesday's edition of Midori House with Tom Edwards, Mary Dejevsky, and Roger Boys. Now, though the United States' half-century blockade of Cuba has been a uniquely American exercise, most other Western nations have somewhat deferred to Washington's sensitivities on the subject, to the extent that no leader of a Western power has set foot in Havana since the 1980s. That diplomatic isolation, at least, has changed. President François Hollande of France has not only visited Cuba, but met the Castros and called for an end for the United States' trade embargo, a sanction which, as of President Barack Obama's outreach last December, would appear to be heading for history's dustbin anyway. Bénédicte Paviot is France 24's London correspondent. She joined Andrew Muller and Dominic Reynolds on Tuesday's edition of The Monocle Daily to discuss how France's perception of Cuba has changed over time.
There have been very deep and long-standing cultural links with France. France has had very warm ties, has been very involved when there was a revolution, I think, and there were a lot of French people kicked out of Santo Domingo. So there is a historical link. And yes, let's remember that Libération had its big headline yesterday where they mocked up, photoshopped President Hollande into Che Guevara. Now, let me say this is not going down terribly well in Paris, particularly not with ex-president Sarkozy, a conservative, who said that it was absolutely shameful, and other people in the conservatives in France who've been saying this is shameful that he should be seen with this former dictator. Let's remember that Reporters Without Borders is reminding President Hollande of what he said in the article I just quoted moments ago in 2003, that he's the same man, François Hollande, who'd asked for the abolition of censorship, and that he'd even said that silence is a form of being complicit with what's going on. And that Reporters Without Borders, let's speak about journalism for a second, places Cuba in 169th rank in 2015, and there are only 880 countries in that rank. So that is not good. But then what the socialists have been pointing out to ex-President Sarkozy and other conservatives is saying, oh, if we had to start the list of dictators that you welcomed in Paris when you were president, Muammar Gaddafi, amongst others, then it would be a long list. So there's been somewhat of trading of insults over this Cuban visit.
Yeah, it sounds like it. And the thing about human rights violations and bad journalistic standards is that they are often quite overlookable when there is economic sort of business to be done.
And a lot of economic business to be done. An oil deal that was struck and announced yesterday at the end of this trip.
Well, this is it. I mean, that's a good defence for Hollande against accusations from the right, isn't it?
At a time when unemployment is still rising in France, for similar populations between the UK and France, there's 1.5 million more unemployed in France. So, of course, yes, to bring back big contracts like this oil deal with the French oil major Total, signed on Monday. That is good news for the French economy. He did not go alone. He went with many senior executives from Accor, from Air France, and other big French companies. So there is a lot of trade. And of course, those cultural links that have existed for a long time, that have just become even greater, will lead to contracts. And that is something that Cuba also is welcoming, because they don't just want, when the embargo is lifted by the Americans, it just to be lots of American contracts.
You mentioned there that Hollande remains still quite spectacularly unpopular in France, but does meeting Castro, especially at this point, help him? Is there a constituency for Fidel Castro in France? Is he an admired figure?
He is seen by some as a hero, and of course by others as that dictator. So yes, he is seen, and that's perfectly fair to say that he, in this 3 years into power of this five-year term, is, if you will, draping himself with the aura of having met Fidel Castro, who, of course, over the years has had both a heroic standing and yet also an infamous standing in France and amongst the French socialists.
Bénédicte Pavillot from France 24 with Andrew Muller and Dominic Reynolds. Coming up, we'll stay with the French theme. This time, we'll peer into the newsroom of Le Monde. Stay tuned. You're listening to The Recap, a look back at our coverage of the week gone by in live news shows hosted here at Monocle 24. I'm Daniel Giacopelli. On Wednesday, the French newspaper Le Monde voted to appoint a new editor, and it's a process that involves more than just the usual interview. It's actually one of the very few newspapers in which staffers have a say in who gets the top job. At Le Monde, new editors must first be selected by the paper's publishers, and then be put to a vote by the title's some 450 staff. If the masses don't approve, then it's back to the drawing board. The vote actually didn't go as planned, with Jérôme Fenoglio, a longtime editor at the paper, failing to win 60% of the votes. But before that vote happened, Georgina Godwin got a primer on the vote from Monocle's Paris correspondent Tom Burgess Watson.
The man thought to be most likely to take the job is Jérôme Fenoglio, which is presumably an Italian name by origin, which has been Francicized. But anyway, he has been very much in the capacity of helping to lead the newspaper ever since the outgoing editorial director, Nathalie Nougared, resigned last year. But what's strange is that there is someone who actually has been the acting editorial director called Gilles Van Cotte, who has been doing that job now ever since his predecessor resigned last year. And he has not been asked, as he was expected to be, to carry on, and he's no longer one of the front-running candidates. Rather, it is the man just beneath him who's filling in his job who will be most likely taking over this Jérôme Fenoglio, who you just mentioned. So quite a confusing story. But Fenoglio has been with the newspaper, as you said, for more than two decades. He's been quite a rising star in the organization, having been editor-in-chief of Le Monde 2. He's also been a foreign correspondent. He's also been editor-in-chief of Le Monde's online edition. So he's going to need to get about 60% of the staff's vote, more than 60% of the staff's vote there from Le Monde today, if he wants to be secured that job.
Let's just have a look at how the paper's set up, a kind of odd ownership deal.
Yes, well, the newspaper has been through its fair share of dramas and complications. It's not often that the newspaper is the news, but in the case of Le Monde, it is extremely often on the front pages of other newspapers because it's been to the brink and back so many times in the last 20 or 30 years that people have almost lost count. But the principal owners of Le Monde today, it's a very improbable trio. The three people are Xavier Niel, who is a billionaire telecom entrepreneur. He's the head of a company called Free, which is the cable TV and internet and mobile phone provider here in France, one of the major ones. Then you have Pierre Berger, who is a co-founder of Yves Saint Laurent and who was a partner of Yves Saint Laurent, a romantic partner. So that's the second owner. And the third one is a man called Mathieu Pigas, who is the vice chairman of Lazard, the investment bank. So you have these three people who really, on the face of it, have very little in common, other than the fact that they came up with the cash the last time Le Monde had a cash flow crisis and they took over the newspaper's ownership. So this very strange structure, where you have these three people at the top, then you have the 450 staff who have the right to vote on who their editorial director is going to be. And it all sounds utopian and rather wonderful, but it just doesn't seem to work all that well when you consider just how many times Le Monde has almost had to go bankrupt and disappear altogether.
As you say, the paper itself is often the story, and there's been a lot of drama there. I mean, the whole involvement with the HSBC Swiss tax avoidance too.
Yes, there was that, and of course there was that, and that story, we're told, divided the three principal owners, who all had a rather different take on, you know, this decision to go after people who had foreign bank accounts in Switzerland, and a difference of opinion as to how that story be handled. But it's not the only controversy. There have been several others. As we said earlier on, Nathalie Nougared, who resigned last year, said that she felt like she was being undermined by one or all three of those men who own the newspaper. She felt she didn't really have enough say and a credible position. Her predecessor, one of her predecessors, just the one before her, died of a heart attack in his office. That was only 3 years ago, so that was another major drama. But I think one of the most serious dramas facing Le Monde is simply the fact that newspaper sales here in France are not on the rise. In fact, Le Monde has seen its newspaper circulation drop to around 300,000 copies a day, which is down around 20% versus 10 to 15 years ago. But still, it does remain the number three newspaper here in France in terms of sales, after the tabloid newspaper Aujourd'hui en France and Le Figaro, which lean slightly to the right. Le Monde has always been thought to lean slightly to the left. It's got a very rich history, and it's a very important symbol of France, having been set up on the request of Charles de Gaulle back in 1944. And it's the one newspaper you can still find, and hopefully you'll still be able to continue to find, on newsstands all around the world.
A Monocle's man in Paris there, Tom Burgess Watson, on Wednesday's edition of The Globalist. To Spain now, where citizens will soon go to the polls to vote on who will run their biggest cities. The results will be a useful barometer for the wider political direction in the country. While on Thursday's edition of The Globalist, Georgina Godwin spoke with our man in Spain, Liam Aldis.
Let's start with Esperanza Aguirre, who is actually expected to win the majority of the vote, but still in the mid-30s. She's a very, very controversial political figure. She's an ex-senator. She's the ex-regional premier of Madrid as well. But she's also a walking headline. She was involved last year in a police car chase because she disputed a parking ticket that she was given after parking her car on the main thoroughfare in Madrid to take some money out of an ATM. She disputed the ticket and got into an argument with the police officer, got in her car, sped off, knocking over the police motorbike in the process, and a police car chase ensued, and she was followed all the way to her house. She's actually also a countess. She comes from a noble family, so she lives in a palace. And this is actually going through the courts right now. She received a small fine, and then some other judges opened the case. Not what you'd want during an election campaign, but she's kind of the Teflon politician. Whatever happens to her, she always seems to get off scot-free. She's a political survivor. She was in a helicopter crash. She walked out of that untouched. She was also in the Mumbai terrorist attack on the hotel in Mumbai. She was actually there when the terrorists started firing. She walked out of that without a scratch. So she's a political survivor and quite controversial, like I said, but she's expected to win a lot of votes from particularly old voters, elderly voters, because she's just one of these politicians that's been around forever. She represents kind of the old political guard, but she has a very, very loyal following from people who say that she says what she thinks, and they like that about her. She's a very strong character, but that also gets her into trouble sometimes. She has another court case at the moment for linking Pablo Iglesias, the leader of Podemos, with the terrorist group ETA. It's a defamation suit. So if she wins, we're looking forward to another 4 years of controversial tenure.
Well, let's see who she's up against. Manuela Carmena.
So Manuela Carmena is part of this new group of citizens and neighborhood association parties that have grouped together to form a new political party called Ahora Madrid. She's coming in second. She's a complete opposite to Esperanza Aguirre. She's not controversial. She's actually an ex-judge. She's 71 years old. She has devoted her entire life to defending the rights of the disadvantaged. She was actually also the survivor of a terrorist attack in 1977. A group of lawyers who were linked to the nascent Communist Party in the post-dictatorship years were attacked. Their office was raided by neo-fascist terrorists, and five of them were killed. She was in the office that day, but in a separate room, and walked out of that unscathed. So she's devoted her entire life to defending the rights of people who have been evicted from their homes. And she's quite a beloved figure, particularly amongst younger voters, despite her age, because she's seen as very genuine and kind of the antithesis to the controversy of her opponent.
Mm. And the third candidate from the Citizens Party.
So this is the first time that the Citizens Party is fielding candidates in Madrid and all around Spain. It's actually a Catalonian party. Begoña Villacís is from the Citizens Party. She actually only joined the party at the beginning of the year when it was announced they were going to field candidates. She's quite young. She's a lawyer as well, but she actually made her name for herself appearing on the tertulias, which are the TV panel shows The very interesting side point about Begonia is that she has appeared on many conservative networks. And this image that the Citizens Party is actually just a new conservative party, which the leader is trying to fight off, is kind of supported by the if you look at some of the backgrounds of some of their candidates, it shows that a lot of them are ex-PP party members or voters. And now they're more seen as more modern, and they're trying to join the Citizens Party.
Mm-hmm. Now, of course, Ana Botella was in charge in Madrid, and she was a hugely colourful character too.
Yeah, colourful for all the wrong reasons as well. She's probably, will go down in history as one of the worst mayors that Madrid's had. She was never voted for. She was handed the job after her predecessor moved to the national government. She was basically not picked by the, in Spain, the candidates are picked basically by the leader of the party and the president of the country. He handpicks everyone. She was performing so badly that he went on to pick Esperanza Aguirre, who, interestingly, is one of the biggest rivals of the current president. So a lot of people are saying that Rajoy has chosen Esperanza Aguirre to keep her busy so she doesn't try and take over the party leadership just before federal elections, which is very unlikely to happen. But if perhaps Rajoy loses in the general elections, Esperanza Aguirre could actually leave the city council and leapfrog into national politics again. That's what many commentators are saying.
Liam Aldous there, speaking to us on Thursday's edition of The Globalist about Spain's upcoming municipal elections. And before we go, one of our favorite monologues from this past week. This week marks the launch of Monocle's inaugural guidebooks to New York and London, with new publications on Tokyo and Hong Kong to follow in the coming months. Well, let's hear now from Josh Fenner, who revisits some of the most reliable travel companions to date.
This week marks the launch of Monocle's inaugural guidebooks to New York and London, with new publications on Tokyo and Hong Kong to follow in the coming months. To honour the much-adored travel companion, I've gathered a few recommendations of other guides worth getting your hands on. I have to declare an interest here first. My very first love and primary motivation for pursuing a career on the printed page were, in fact, the Lonely Planet travel guides. The distinctive blue-bordered books, the curly loops and finials of its logo, and the relentlessly dense listings sparked something in me. They inspired a sense of adventure and an awe at the doubtlessly interesting souls who spent time capturing and distilling evocative and unknowable cities and faraway nations into beautiful books. I've been hooked ever since. Sadly, the last time this venerable brand made headlines was in 2013, when the US billionaire Brad Kelly bought it for £51.5 million. Some 70 staff were immediately cut. Tremors were felt throughout the industry, and death knells were sounded for the printed guide, but prematurely, I'd argue. While these remain challenging times for the print industry, and readers have dwindled and established mastheads have faltered, the more and more interesting independent voices have chirped up pleasingly. There's the lolling, soulful prose of Taylor Bruce's colourful Wild Sam guides, which started in the southern states of the US but crept north to include Detroit and a forthcoming Brooklyn instalment. There's Sondre Sommerfeldt's arrestingly unserious and surreal take on his austere hometown of Oslo, captured in the loquaciously titled A Poor Man's Connoisseur Guide to Happy Living in One of the Most Expensive Cities in the World. For a neighbourhood-by-neighbourhood take on tackling a destination, few guides compare to New York-based Alana Sloan's Analog series, the flame-red Los Angeles edition of which usefully accompanied me on a trip to the city last spring. From the UK, we have Serial's pristine and design-minded rendition of London. Readers are treated to an image of the UK capital as an almost unrecognisably unpeopled maze, artfully shot and stripped of its cacophony and restlessness. It's the travel guide's capacity to reinterpret the familiar and reveal exciting glimpses of the unknown, which keeps the industry current and the ideas fresh. Needless to say, we hope you'll find the same excitement and awe and sense of discovery in our additions to the travel section, which will be available from all good bookstores from this week onwards. For Monocle, I'm Josh Fennett.
Well, that's all we've got time for on this week's edition of The Recap. This show is edited by Sam Impey, and I'm Daniel Giacopelli. Join us again next week to hear some of the very best of our live news programs right here on Monocle 24. But for now, from me, Daniel Giacopelli, thanks for listening. Goodbye.